Кстати, started discussion, if a question this, they do not, lose mass.
No, but I mean, it depends how they lose mass. So
Saturn's rings. No, well, it would, yeah, there are too many satellites confining them, I guess.
It might be decretion. I mean, people have argued that, you know, satellites formed from the ring.
And probably.
That's the only accretion disk I know that has real viscosity.
Maybe more important how much mass they lose, but I'm not going to talk about that because I have no idea.
It depends on the accretion rate, no?
Yes.
In a non-standard way, right?
No, it's pretty standard. Well, I mean,
But as of this morning, it's that changed. Yeah, but no rain, right?
I think I had enough rain for work.
I guess we can go ahead and get started. It's like that.
Okay. Well, I was hoping that Christian will show up. But so I'm going to talk about things that I'm working now, and this title is probably misleading. But this is something that is not very often discussed. There are these strange novas. Strange because they are not classical nova. They contain red dwarf, red giant, or whatever. But anyway, the best way of explaining their light curves is V1309 Scorpius and another famous member V8381 is that they are losing this matter from the L2 point, and it forms clouds around them, which obscure sometimes the central source. And this was treated all the way back in 79 by Shu, Anderson, Lubov, this loss of mass through the L2. And nowadays there are probably better numerical simulations. One I found this one by Beja. I don't know how to pronounce this correctly, which they show that depending on the mass ratio, loss of...
I'm sorry, but I think we don't understand what you're talking about. You should present what is, a light cap or something.
I will show, okay, because...
Because, you know, you are starting with presenting the model of something we know nothing about.
Exactly. I thought because most of the people here are theorists, they would be interested in it.
Most people here, including me, don't know nothing. The first time I hear about this object. So
this is not kind of object that I'm going to talk. The point of me showing this is because these codes, these models can be applied to classical nova also very much. Another approach is by this, you will be very skeptical about this. But again, it is different approach. But people show that there is an outflow from the backside of the disk. And it was applied to a wrong system with the wrong parameters. But that doesn't matter. If you have something like 6-hour binary, close binary with compact object, and you have that much mass transfer, you may have outflow from the L2 point or the back of the disk. So what I'm going to talk is NOVA-likes or high mass transfer rate CVs. The NOVA-likes don't show any eruptive activity. That's why they are called NOVA-likes. Probably at some point in their life they will be or have been NOVAs. We just missed that event. And most of them are tend to be with the orbital periods above 3 hours. And there is a certain separation of the types of NOVA-likes. The ones that are concentrated between 3 and 4 hours, which are called SVSX objects, and the objects that are above in 4-6 hour range. So because of this high mass transfer rate, that the disks in NOVA-likes are mostly optically thick, and they don't usually show the kind of beautiful double peaked emission lines like we used to see in dwarf NOVA. They often have a wide absorption throats filled with emission emission line in the middle, and sometimes they're featureless, just a continuum. And some of them, like the SVSX stars, they show emission lines similar to dwarf NOVA, but unlike dwarf NOVA, they are all single peaked emission lines, whether SVSX objects are all, most of them are eclipsing, deep eclipses, so they are high inclination systems. So that single peaked profiles were like a little bit paradigm. These NOVA-likes are often interpreted having strong winds, and especially in UV spectra, they show pretty good evidence of wind. But what I'm trying to show here now is that the wind probably is not the only only mechanism which works here in a sense of loss of matter. So here are these SVS objects, which are concentrated in this 3-4 hour range of orbital periods. And we have studied one of them very detailed. And we were able to pretty much explain all the observational characteristics by this model, in which the disk in the system, as I said, usually they are optically thick and they don't contribute much in the emission lines. And in these SVSX objects, the most of the line forming region is this hot spot or hot line, as it is called by some people, because it is extended and stratified by the temperature. So emission lines come from this narrow part of the disk. And this is explained, this explains the most outstanding feature of SVSX stars, that the eclipse in these stars doesn't coincide with the zero velocity crossing of emission lines. Here, on the bottom, you see the emission lines. The dots are the measurements, and the blue line is the fit to the measurements, which corresponds in our model to this hot line. Above is the light curve, And the light curve is described by contribution of this hotspot, the disk, red, and the secondary is this maroon, brownish light curve. The white dwarf is much lower, so it doesn't appear here. So, if you plot the real radial velocities of stellar components, which is this brown corresponding to the secondary, and the light blue corresponding to the primary, you see that in emission lines of this single emission lines of SS stars, we never see the stellar components. We measure only emission line. The emission lines come from this hot spot, and that's what we measure. And if we check different lines of different ionization level, we see that the H alpha has the largest amplitude, and it's the most shifted to the from the eclipse. The H beta and then helium 2 have smaller and smaller amplitudes, and there is a clear phase shift between these lines, which we explain by the stratification of temperature or where the bulk of emission lines is formed. So helium 2 is formed closer to the impact of the stream, and then temperature is going decreasing along the as the matter starts to rotate around the disk. Then comes H beta and H alpha.
Well, don't see the other part. I don't see from this geometry, I don't see.
Which part?
Why don't see lines from the blue shifted part?
Because there is no emission lines formed in this part of the disk.
Why?
Because the disk is optically thick there. Optically thick there. There is no emission. I mean, probably there is some emission, but it is in this contrast of these lines, you don't see them. The predominantly lines that we see are coming only from this side of the disk.
I can't see the wavelength scale here. Can you say a little bit about what the line, which the
issue is? I'm not sure, but this is a disk, okay? It rotates, so how can you have only one part that is optical? It's in that one, think I don't understand.
This is the splashdown.
Because this is where
this is the stream, or it's what?
Yeah, it's the stream. It's the stream where the incoming
stream would extend all.
Yes. As I said, it's not a spot, as we usually call it, bright spot, but it's a more extended stream where the matter enters. It has higher temperature.
The stream doesn't go like that. It's because there's no around it. It's kinematically impossible. It's not going to go like that. It's going to go.
Well, it goes.
No.
It goes like this.
Yeah, it goes like this and go like that.
Yeah.
So how can you go along the rim?
Surely that depends upon the relative thickness of the stream.
Maybe it's not the stream, maybe it is the...
But the point is it's only...
The hot spot is the particle spread, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So Neil had also asked...
It's not the stream, I mean, it's the... I know...
It is a hot spot which is extended or elongated.
Okay, so look...
What line?
Neil?
Neil had asked a question.
Can you say a little bit about what are the species that are emitting in the hot, in this extended hotspot?
Species?
So which atoms or ions are producing the light?
Well, the mostly it's hydrogen and helium that we see.
I see. Oh, I see there. So it's helium.
It's helium 2, H beta and H alpha.
What would be the extension of the of this area which is emitting the lines in terms of, I mean, a square?
In the paper we have the angles, these angles that separate them, but I don't remember now.
I mean, is it a quarter of the the disk or, I mean, less than that, more than that?
What determines the extent, the angular extent? Is it cooling, like, so?
It's cooling, but I don't know.
I mean, it has to remain optically thin if you want to
Yes.
lines, so.
It should be optically thin to produce emission lines.
So then it is probably, okay, did you estimate the cooling time?
No. I'm just describing observations and where the emission lines should come from to be seen like that.
The implications of the cooling time is going to be very fast.
And I mean, when I'm pointing here, it doesn't mean that helium-2 comes only from this point and the HBT comes from this point. They come from everywhere. But if you and the spread of points is very large, so it's just the center of mass of.
Yeah, these are unusual in that the helium-2 is so strong.
Yeah.
Because I mean, they're usually in a dwarf nova.
You don't see hot.
Less of a helium-2, but in these, the helium-2 is stronger than H-beta in many cases, so it's quite a...
So what's different about these systems? I mean,
very high accretion rates in that.
Very high accretion. They have these are nova lights.
This is that interval between 3 and 4 hours. They, you know, just some... Something happens in that interval.
And probably the vertical extent of the disk is pretty high here compared to dwarf nova or other.
I mean, some of the models have, you know, the impact hitting the disk and then sweeping over because the impact rate is so high. I mean, that's Don's Ford's model. It's just this big splash over. So it could, you know, this is like, it can go downstream, but it can also go over. In some of the models that have been made.
So this model helps us to explain the behavior of all of these emission lines. There are these interesting details like this zigzag here and this extended tail, which all explained by the, like this zigzag is because the at 0.8, the stellar component or the white dwarf starts to decrease its velocity, while the hotspot is still on the rise. So there is this when it is eclipsed, some part of the hotspot is eclipsed. Then you start to see faint emission from the rest of the disk, and then it goes that way. But then the hotspot appears again, and it goes the other way, and it goes to very high velocities. But that's not the point I'm going to talk. The important thing is that I want to mention here is that in these SWW6 stars, the emission-producing region is this hotspot or hotline, which is the point where the stream impacts the disk. And the second point that I want to make that in these systems, in all of them, we observe some transient absorption lines. And this is, for example, magnesium 1 at 5,100 angstrom, somewhere there. And as you see, it's a duplet. As you see, we see the line around the phase 0,5. This is double, this is two periods, so this is repeats. This 0.5, where the line appears, and then it's basically gone. So we think that these absorption lines are formed in this area here, where the gas is leaves the accretion disk, and it's less dense. And it is you see the optically thick accretion disk behind, and then gas and then the emission is being absorbed and produces absorption lines, and the magnesium line needs some 4,500 degrees, like in late K stars, and. That's exactly what the temperature of the outer edge of the disk would be. So somewhat it works like an atmosphere of a star. And that's what we consider an evidence that in this high accretion, high mass transfer rate Novalax, we do see evidence of mass loss through the L2 point. Now, if you move to longer periods, systems with about 6 hour orbital period, here the picture of emission lines is completely different. Like in this object, RW6, you see two components of the emission lines. This narrow, strong component is obviously coming from the irradiated surface of the secondary star, L1 point. And when you take it off the spectra of the line, then you see this extended emission, which is located completely in a different part. I mean, almost opposite side of the impact or hotspot, where the SWS6 stars were emitting emission lines. So, in SWS6 stars, which I showed previously, the emissions are forming in this part where the stream hits the disk and creates this long hotspot. In this object, and this is not the only one, in most of them, this emission comes and it's extended. It comes not from the entire disk, it comes from this right bottom part of the tomogram.
Sorry, what was the difference between the HR from the second line and the HR from the
second line? Here we extracted the narrow component. It's the same line, but we extracted the narrow component. It's not perfect, you still see some part of it, but when you extract, you see this wide component, large velocity component, much clearer than you see here. And here you almost don't see this emission, but when you subtract the narrow component, you start to see this where this wide component is coming from. And what is strange, that this white component is not coming from the inside of the disk. This circle here, black circle here, is the outer edge of the accretion disk. It corresponds to about 250 kilometers per second, which is the outer edge of the accretion disk. So these lines are formed on this back part of the accretion disk, but not in the disk. And as in the SWS6 stars, we also see some accretion absorptions in here it is iron line, and we see emission and we see absorption, and emission again comes from the irradiated surface of the secondary star. But the absorption, which you see very faint, this black curve here, it comes from the same place from where these wide emission lines are coming. So you see, if I overpose this over the ferrum line, and you see that. Although this line is very faint, we cannot measure it, but it coincides very well with this white component. So again, we have absorption lines forming in this part of the tomogram, which is backside of the disk, but not in the disk, but outside of the disk. We take another object, which is 6 hour orbital period system, but it shows features similar to SW6 and some features that don't correspond. But we see basically the same thing here, two component emission lines. One is from the narrow component. The other is here, sorry. This is the airway 6 and this is the RXG, whatever. So if you compare them, you see that they are basically producing the same kind of emission lines. And you see also irradiated secondary here. And when you take irradiated secondary off, you see this extended emission at the back of the disk, but with velocities that are less than the lowest velocity in the disk. Now, what's important about this object is that it is eclipsing, so the parameters are better determined, and also you can fix some other things. And it shows helium-2 line, which is completely different than hydrogen lines. So Balmer lines are formed in this part, which I was explaining previously, but the helium line is totally concentrated around the white dwarf or inner part of the disk, and this is probably a boundary layer or some kind of a wind, but helium-2 is formed in a different, and this is a good evidence that these two lines are formed in completely different places in the same system. And this system also shows transient absorption lines around phase 0.5. We modeled this object because it's eclipsing. And as you see here in the model, which is made the same way as the SW6 model, you see the contribution of the hotspot is very small compared to the SW6 stars. And when the system goes into the eclipse, this is the equivalent width of H alpha line. The emission lines are not absorbed. So when we look at the system in the eclipse, where majority of the disk is absorbed is eclipsed, we still see a lot the emission lines from hydrogen doesn't disappear because they are, according to us, they are formed here behind the disk. Meanwhile, helium-2 is absorbed and it shows eclipses, because it comes from the center inner parts of the disk. Here are these different components of the model. And finally, I want to show you another object which has a perfectly the same kind of spectrum that RW6, which I showed previously. It has also this two components of emission lines, perfectly in the same places where the RW6. But here I overposed the lines from this object on the RW6. I had to cut it on the larger velocities because it is a former nova and there are some other stuff going on in the wings of the line. And this is the image of this object, and this is image of another nova-like, where you see the nova shell. So what is interesting here is that people are looking for these nova shells in different stars, and they don't. For example, these asynchronous polars, which are supposed to be asynchronous because they experience some kind of nova eruption, people were looking around them. They don't see shells. Whether around these star objects, which have a high accretion rate, we find easily these nova shells. I think this can be a pretty good evidence that you have to have a matter around the object to when you blow it up in nova eruption to form the nova shell. It's not just the eruption that creates the shell, but there should be a matter around it to form this. And this matter is the matter lost by the system from this outflow from the L2 point.
Sorry, I missed probably something, but why do you need additional matter? Why is it not simply the matter which is ejected from the...
Because you don't see these shells everywhere. You see them in only...
Shortly, after 50,000 years or so, the shells are gone.
No, of course, it's not the only reason. I'm not saying that that's the only reason. I'm just baffled by this, that in these high accretion rate systems, like this paper by Shara came out recently, and he shows that it happened 300, 400 years ago, the Nova outburst. By the velocities of the of the of the, this. So basically the message I wanted to convey is that whenever you have a very high mass transfer rate, you probably can see have some observational evidence of mass lost through the L2 point of the backside of the disk, which is natural, but it's not easily observed. And I think here we have the evidence.
Well, I think you have to make the caveat that the atomograms don't give you the vertical structure, right? So
yes, of course.
You can't locate it like in the plane, but it could be.
If there were no disabsorption, transient absorption lines appearing at this particular phase, and if these tomograms were a little bit different from system to system, depending on their inclination angle, I would say that this might be a wind. This might be something above the plane, which tomogram doesn't treat correctly.
So these weren't all eclipsing systems?
Huh?
These weren't all eclipsing systems?
No, no.
This
RVSX is not eclipsing. This one is not eclipsing. And this only the previous one. This one is eclipsing, but they show absolutely the same kind of tomogram. And I agree, the tomograms can go really wrong if you have a matter above the orbital plane. They don't treat it correctly. And here, I mean, in this cartoon. In this cartoon, the line might come from something above the accretion disk or come from this backside, right?
Right. Yeah, because you don't have any information about the vertical structure of the tomograph. You just have...
So in other words, there's an alternative explanation. It doesn't have to be outflow from an L2 point. It could be...
It could be absorption in a wind that's being backlit by either the inner disk or the...
But the fact that it comes at different inclinations is interesting.
Well, that's something that you have to figure out as a geometry, right? But if you think of a thick wind blowing off the disk, well, take that geometry, right, that you have right there. If you think of a wind that comes vertically off the disk, right, and now you put your viewpoint from the left, basically, right, you can see that wind being backlit by either the hotspot or the inner disk, or but by a hot part in the disk, and that's a natural sort of geometry to create absorption lines.
Yeah, but why do you see them only in around phase 0.5?
Well, so that would be naturally explained if it's the hotspot that loses the backlighting, right? So that if it's not the inner disk. If it's the inner disk, I agree, then you should see them basically at all phases, right? But also, now actually, if you,
Yeah, this is not the explanation. There are alternatives, or this is the alternative to the usual explanation, which is wind.
And that's actually interesting. If it is really this, like this, I have to think about this. This is correct.
And Jean-Pierre asked me why I'm talking about these things in the beginning, because I wanted to say that there is a stronger evidence in a non-classical.
I was not asking why I was just attracting your attention that if you start like that, most people don't know what you are talking about.
Yes, I agree.
So it was not my opinion, but most people are not specialists here. So if you start with something like that, they start reading their own email. It's the reaction I've seen before. That's why I wanted you to.
I know,
what you're talking about.
I hate that, but there is no other way of presenting cataclysmic variables. You say SW6 stars, and most of the people don't know what does it mean.
I try to Google it. It's a bad idea.
So the fact that the cores of these emission lines remain visible during eclipse is something that we see in more systems, not just the SW6 stars.
On the high inclination ones, yeah.
Yeah, not all of them, I would say, but if you look at them, a fair number of them, or the majority of them in detail, you see that some fraction of the emission remains. So I think that is another indication that there's something that is especially above the wind.
And helium-2 is...
Oh yeah, but that's just a temperature effect, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you need a high temperature to get helium-2 excited, right? Because
the
excitation potential is very
helium-2 high. Helium-2 is behind this. Helium-2 is behind this.
Yeah, so the helium-2 comes from the center of the disk, or from the white dwarf, or from the bottom layer. I mean, that's difficult to resolve, right, spatially. But you see this also in spectral eclipse mapping. You see that the helium-2 is much more concentrated towards the center of the disk than the Balmer lines. But that makes sense if you think of the temperature increasing towards the center of the disk.
Yeah, that's what I thought in your other map, the first one that you showed. You had that big extended section, but you had the helium-2 coming from the outer part of the disk. And that's too hot. If you had hot spots, aren't
in this?
Helium-2, you'd have to be over 20,000.
The hotspot can do it.
It's hot enough for
helium-2 to hotspot.
You
need a hot disk, right?
Yeah, we've done temperatures of some of the hotspots, and they're like 12,000. That's a dwarf novae. I mean, would you get
you mean this?
Hotter?
Yeah. Yeah. You can get helium-2
from the outer parts.
That's okay.
But
seen that before.
That's
I would think the main part would be from the.
That's why it's not only
here's foreshortened.
This difference is very marked between these 3-4 hour systems and 4-6 hour systems. Where here, the for whatever reason, the spot is much brighter, is much it's the emission forming region. Whether when you move to 6 hours, you don't see that spot anymore. You don't see helium-2 coming from the hotspot. You see helium-2 coming from the inner side, the inner part of the.
But here again, I think it's good to repeat Paul Ascati has from just before, is that if any of this velocity component is out of the plane, then also the radial velocity phasing changes. I mean, there's different stars where it basically makes no sense at all if you compare the geometry of the eclipse, if you the real geometry and the real phasing, with the phasing of the emission lines.
Right.
So then there's no way to make them.
I know at least four different explanations for SW6 stars.
So it's
and they all have conflicting.
So if you know from a geometric argument like the eclipse what the real phasing of the system is, then right, it's you can try to phase up the radial velocity variations with the phasing that you get from the eclipse. If you do that, you see it's often quite difficult to actually put a specific point in the disk at which.
Okay, I probably was too speaking too fast. But if it's somewhere else, if it's not spot, if it's not velocities in the spot, you wouldn't see this. You wouldn't see this zigzag. If it's coming from the wind, you wouldn't see all these details. We are explaining all these details by the partial coverage by the secondary of this long line.
Yeah,
Yeah, so I'm not saying that it's incorrect in this particular system. I'm just saying that in general, it's difficult to trace them. It's not a consistent picture that we're seeing, unfortunately, right?
Yes.
But I, you know, one thing in support of mass coming out of the L2 is, I mean, there's a Christian doesn't believe the infrared, but there are these infrared measurements of circumbinary stuff out there, in the Nova Likes. So the stuff has to get out there somehow. So the question is it constantly replenished through mass loss, or is it left over from formation through the?
If you look, I didn't go into the detail here. If you look at this old Nova, which is we are still doing this in the we're in the process. I don't have a still very clear picture. I have light curves in VVRI, and you see this is not a large amplitude. It's only 0.1 magnitude, but you see the infrared. I don't have the plot here. The amplitude of this variability changes. It becomes stronger in infrared towards I. Okay, so this is phase 0.5. At phase 0.5, there is some kind of cold thing contributing to the emission. In B, it's all practically flat. In V, you start to see this. In R, it's getting better and stronger, and the strongest is it's in I. How you would explain that in a accretion disk of a nova-like with a high temperature, rather either it's a matter outside of the disk, behind the disk.
Can I ask a general ignorant question? Is there a good review article where all of these different classes?
Warner's book.
Warner's
like
book.
The classic
okay.
book.
And
but it's 95.
He discusses RW sex stars.
Yeah.
All of
they've
this
been known for a while.
And all the gory.
Yeah, right. And the magnetic systems.
I don't want to touch the magnetic system.
The Warner book, which I call Bible, is unfortunately is 95, so a lot of things
happen.
Right. So there's no like brief review.
Yeah. Which just lays out what these systems are.
If you were having a brief review, I don't think you would enter into details of things like SW stars. If the review is brief, then you don't enter in this specific classification, and you don't enter in the details. So it has to be relatively long if you want to enter in the research.
I think Christian's review from 2011, although it was basically focused on the period gap and
the moderators.
More the secondaries, but it gives a nice sort of overview of the evolution or stages as well, right? And
does it go into different types, though?
No. He tries to avoid that, luckily.
Right.
But it's good to sort of have that picture in mind that, you know, they come in at least the classic picture is that they come in at a long orbital period, are in a high mass transfer rate state. Then something weird happens just above the period gap, and then you get all these strange phenomena here, right? Because
But that may be connected to just more evolved secondary or something, right?
Well,
that's one of the ideas.
Yeah, so
yeah, there are two things.
The secondary gets out of thermal equilibrium and then gets bloated, and then something happens that they switch off, they go into the period gap, gravitational wave radiation just brings them together again at around 2 hours, and then you get into the period below the period gap where we generally see more of the dwarf novae. So that's sort of why these SW sex stars happen to be prominent right above the period gap, because
so it's that peak in the distribution
right.
above the period gap, 3 to 4
yes.
hours.
Right,
as you were
that's
long.
Where all this very strange behavior.
And the white dwarfs are all hot, pretty much there. So
the disk is hot. The white dwarf is hot
because of the high accretion rate. But
right.
The thing to get that high of accretion rate, you're basically, one of the ideas you have to be born there, right? Because how could you enhance it
That's a good question, Paula. I think that's
because you think tried, you know, radiation. Right. You know, you can't get an enhancement of that size because there's nothing happening after that. So you basically have to invoke some weird birth rate right there.
I think ideally, if you have precise measurement of orbital period, m dot, and magnetic field, you can classify CV. But unfortunately, we don't have these two parameters, and we have to call them names.
This is what astronomy works on. But so here's a young person. He's starting to work on global simulations with MRI of accretion disks and binary systems with the stream feeding and everything. So
don't start. This is the last one you tackle after you've understood everything else. And then you go in and say, okay, now that we understand, you know, normal systems at longer periods, and we understand lower mass transfer rate systems at shorter periods. If we understand all of that, then we go and start tackling this, I would say.
Okay, but because of you, he's actually working on AM campaigns.
Well, those are, but that's good. That's good because those are even simpler, right? So that's, you made the right choice. Right?
Okay. Just checking.
That's fine.
Anyway, Christian's, so there's Brian Warner's book and then Christian's 2011?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not aware of anything more recent than that, right? The sort of vision of.
I don't think there is any.
So can I ask another naive question? So talking about the evolution of these systems, mm-hmm. where the long-term evolution is affected by the nature of the wind, you know, the way the momentum is carried off the system, and these different scenarios have very different implications for long-term evolution. So do we understand enough from the data about the actual evolution of the systems to be able to back out?
We do have a general picture as Paul said, that they go from the longer periods to shorter periods, that probably because the magnetic rating stops, they go into this period gap, and then they emerge from the period gap because gravitational waves starting to work. In general terms, we know that this happens. But why, like, why the accretion rate changes so drastically in this particular part, I cannot say that we are sure, or because of the m dot changes, why these accretion disk flows are changing. Or
so not necessarily these more complex systems, but in general terms, you know, is there any stage, is there any one of these CV systems, or category of CV systems?
Mm-hmm.
Are there any of these CV systems where we can use the evolution of the binary as a probe of the angular momentum loss to outflows?
No.
For example, in the gravitational wave losses.
It's not enough. So that's been clear because there's too much of a spread in the m dots for that region. So there has to be some. So they say below the gap, it should just be gravitational radiation. That's not enough. There has to be another component. Yeah. And usually it said, well, there must be some residual magnetic breaking, but we don't really know. So maybe there's some mass loss or something.
More or less, we see evolution clearly by looking at the spectral type of the secondary. And that's why the Christian's paper is important. Because
so you can rule out sort of the simple textbook conservative system.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's recently been a couple of studies by Matthias Schreiber and his group from Chile. And also by Gijs Nellemans on, for instance, the influence of the angular momentum that you lose in novae outbursts and the effect on the evolution. And they point out that this actually could have a significant effect on the overall evolution of the CV. If this happens like hundreds of times during this period, that actually the accumulated mass loss from that may actually also drive part of the evolution. Whether that is happening, yes or no, but that's very difficult to find out.
Well, I didn't mention angular momentum loss. I said mass loss because I don't know much about that. But this system, V1309, is famous also because it's a orbital period very rapidly. It's decreasing like crazy, and the reason is that because it loses the mass from the old point.
Okay.
So that's.
What sort of system is this?
Maybe a comment about the evolution testing. If you don't put the numbers.
Oh, I see.
Okay, you put the numbers and you, the standard version of the evolution is something called magnetic braking, that we know it exists because, for example, operates in the sun. It's magnetic braking plus gravitational radiation above 3 hours. And then there is the gap because for some reason the star becomes.
So even more, what do you mean by gravitational by magnetic braking? If I can see.
And the momentum loss because the gas is remains attached to the.
But I consider the binary system as a whole.
Yeah.
Okay, as an isolated system, a binary system.
Yes.
I mean, we're not saying the last magnetic field threat for the whole thing that's breaking it down. So what is breaking what?
The secondary is losing magnetic wind. Its rotation is.
Because of the coupling of the rotation
effect. It is standardly locked in the system, so it removes.
And it's losing, it's got a magnetic.
Yeah, it's losing angular momentum from the orbit. It's losing its own, but since it's coupled to the orbit, it loses angular, orbital angular
momentum. Yeah. Does that mean we know the magnetic field in this?
No. The magnetic field of the secondary.
So does that mean we know the magnetic flux that's coming in through the stream into the accretion disk?
No, this is the problem is very funny that there are two mechanisms. One is gravitational waves, the other is magnetic braking, and of course we know everything about gravitational waves. So general relativity is trivial and magnetic braking is complicated. And there are various models and we don't know. We know that we can observe single stars and measure their rotation with age, and we see that so we can somehow imitate it. There are some theoretical arguments in Kalman models how a magnetic wind from a star like the sun slows down the rotation. But this is to be applied to a dwarf star that are not directly observed. That is, it's really the Soros law in a binary system. So the extrapolation is dubious. So there's been an incessant discussion what is the model. The correct model, and there are various models, but sometimes they give, you know, the transfer rate that increases with period, that is more or less constant with period. Some of them can decrease with period. It seems that it should be, it also observationally is not absolutely clear what it should be, because one should keep in mind that when you observe a system. There's no guarantee of observing that the secular mass transfer rate. They are huge, as all of it, they are huge. At the same period, according to the theory, they should be roughly having the same mass transfer rate, but they don't. Some of them even stop transferring mass for a few months, for example.
But that just means that there's not a unique relationship between all those. That simply means that there's not a unique relationship between orbital period and
the secular time is above the gap is the secular time is 10 to the 8 years, 10 to the 9, 10 to the 8 years. But within that, for example, people like very much hot spots or magnetic spots, and you know. Going around and stopping, the star can oscillate. You know, there are various possibilities. These are boring dwarfs, but still they have their own life. You see, so
right. But you know where I'm going with this kind of questioning, right?
No, so the reason why there is no one-to-one relation between the mass transfer rate and the orbital period is because low mass stars are complicated.
Yeah.
right? And they're stars, right? So they could, A, they're complicated by themselves, right? Because of the magnetic field structure, etc. But also, they could be in various stages of their own internal evolution.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
So that makes that more complicated. Okay. And that probably drives a lot of the variability that we see.
Right. Okay. But you also get some constraints on the angular momentum. Power, the you know, the rate of the angular momentum, because you look at population models, and so you can predict if you start out, you know, with a certain law, how many you should get at each stage.
Well, but there you must be able to, I mean, I understand that the models are complicated.
May I suggest something?
Yes.
We have among us, that he's not here today, but it's Christian is a great specialist. And
He wasn't feeling very well.
No, he knows all the subtleties. He wrote a very influential paper with Isabel Baraf and John Patterson that has got hundreds of citations. Because if you want to know what we know and we don't know, it's you just take this paper. So you know, we have him here. I suggest.
Okay, I think
but the other thing is you were asking.
What I wanted just to tell you that if you use the standard model, it reproduces roughly the distribution of systems of series above the gap.
The standard model being just concept.
I mean, there is some standard. Okay, standard. There is a standard general relativity, and there is some. I don't know. What is now, because I haven't worked on this subject for years, but there is some consensus magnetic braking, okay? Something that is probably best reproduces the distribution. Okay, so it reduces the gap and the width of the gap, and then the distribution of the systems below the gap, they are supposed by the model to be run purely by gravitational radiation. Then there is the period minimum that was explained in 1980 by Bogdan Baczynski, which is the result of gravitational radiation and the evolution of the star. So all this is reproduced, and it's not still. And then the systems go to period minimum. So the minimum, the period afterwards they become degenerate, and the period increases, and it's. I think it's still debatable, have we seen such systems that are, you know, after the gap, because they are very faint. And some of them are, I think, very good candidates. But, so the standard model reproduces this. Can you show the histogram? It reproduces roughly the histogram. Now, if you put the exact numbers, for example, the period
but this
minimum,
is not the real one, it's only SW6.
The period minimum is, what is the period?
81.
This is not everybody.
No.
The period minimum is according to the, if it is pure gravitational radiation, it's 79 minutes something.
What happens at that
point? Sorry? The secondary is not degenerate. So it's
changing the way the X1. We discovered that before the Banner and Pulsar, so it would be a test of general relativity. But it wouldn't be because the real minimum period is at 76 or something. And it is normally explained that some magnetic braking is still operating below the gap. The gap is, of course, there are systems in the gap because nothing can prevent a pre-categorical variable to form, to become a CV in the gap. So we expect system in the gap because they don't evolve as CVs through the gap. I mean, the gap is full of systems, but you don't see them. They are detached. So they are either they are detached through evolution or they are pre-cataclysmic. And if you want to, if you now plot not the number but the transfer rate, this is also debatable, but in details. And and Christian had a very good idea to produce sort of a synthetic model. It's not a real model, but it's the model that fits best the data and see what are the differences between the standard model and this sort of made-up model. And I suggest that he gives a talk about that.
Okay, I think that would be very useful. Again, just to, the big thing for, you saw yesterday in Jake's talk how, I mean, from Vlad's question, how desperate the protoplanetary disk community is to measure magnetic fields in protoplanetary disks. Are CVs, I throw down the gauntlet to all of you. Can you prove that they're superior once again to all other accretion disk systems, that we can actually have observational constraints on magnetic fields, on global magnetic fields?
Let me turn the question around. Okay. If you were to measure the mass loss from the sun,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And you say, okay, this is all due to magnetic braking.
Yes.
Right?
And we know the field of the
solar.
Can you
get the field out? Yeah.
So, would you be able to predict the magnetic field strength at any given point on the solar surface? Because that's what you're asking. You're asking what is the injection of magnetic
field.
No, you're asking what's the magnetic field, injection of magnetic field through the stream into the disk, right?
Yes.
Then you want to know the exact magnetic field strength at any point on the star. We can't even do it for the sun, right?
No, even
so
give me
it's hopeless to try anything that you can do it for the secondary.
But
global doesn't tell you anything.
You are interested in not the dipole field, because those Roma stars have high multiple components.
Exactly.
I know.
This is observed.
I know.
This is observed by their X-ray emission.
So yeah, even if
you
know
it, the X-ray active, whereas you assume that the dipole has almost vanished.
Yeah.
And I mean, there can be orders of magnitude between the dipolar field and the quadrupolar field or higher orders.
So
basically, you can use whatever you want.
You can.
No, all I'm saying is that the observations of global measurements of the magnetic field
I'm going to say something controversial here. That we will never be able to use CV observations to constrain the angular momentum transport mechanisms in accretion disks, because we have no idea and never will have any idea of what the field in the disk is.
No, that's incorrect, because you can make the assumption that there's no seed magnetic field being transferred to the disk from the secondary star.
MRI and conduction.
Exactly.
It's because you've drunk our Kool-Aid. Okay.
Or you can make the reverse, the more extreme assumption that there is a magnetic field, which is kilogauss from the secondary, and see what it gives.
Kilogauss is the reasonable field. I mean, orders of magnitude uncertainty.
But we
can
guess a field for the white dwarf, at least.
No, but Omer is concerned about, the affection of magnetic field to the disk from the secondary. It's likely that they're actually higher than in single star because of what Jean-Pierre said. They're in fast rotating binaries, right? So they're locked to the Roche geometry, and they're convective, and they have rotational periods of hours. Right.
So you can infer that in part from the X-ray emission of those low mass stars, especially those which are rapidly rotating.
But there are very few low-mass stars that are rapidly rotating and old.
Most
of them are very young because of
this. So probably the sort of thing I would imagine as being some sort of upper limit.
That's what I need.
So, I mean, it's between zero and one.
Have you written that down? Upper limit on the magnetic field of the stream is kilogauss. And that gives us our range from zero to 10 to the 3.
The best indicator would be a detached system in the period gap, right? Because then it is almost filling its trough hole, right? It's in the period gap, so it's probably still tightly locked, right? Because it's almost there. It's not mass transferring. And there's no accretion going on to mess up all the X-rays coming out of it. And then if you measure its X-ray luminosity, that might be giving you an indication of the X-ray.
And do such observations exist?
No idea. Working on it. There you go.
There are systems we see because there is still accretion, and it's because there is a magnetic field, and the accretion is not.
But you don't want any accretion to answer almost. Right?
Yeah, that's what
You want a system that stops accreting.
I'm saying we probably see some, but because of accretion. If there is no accretion, they are too faint probably to be.
But or discernible from
in X-rays, you mean?
In X-rays.
Yeah. In X-rays. So, but then that gives you the X-ray limit, gives you a limit on.
Okay.
But if you tell me what the structure of a low mass star corona is, I'd be happy to translate that into X-ray limit.
But given that, let's say we knew what the blue strength was. Do we understand, let's say we put a star, stick a dipole on, and put it in a Roche potential. Do we understand the dragging of the magnetic flux from the star into the disk?
No, but, Sasha, the point is that the we as a community are now crossing this threshold where we're going to be doing such simulations. So we're going to start to begin to understand that. But we need observational constraints.
Well, you can turn it around.
I would turn it around. Just give it the seed field and see what happens.
Yeah. And then generate the magnetic wind as well and can calculate the resulting accretion rate and all that. Oh, God.
See if you get all this weird phenomenology and stuff like that, right? Simulate the observations. Don't simulate simulation. Simulate the observations. There you go.
You all are asking too much.
We would give you the same answer.
Well, then it would change the limit, too, if you can't. I mean, if you can constrain, say, it can't be kilogauss, it's got to be lower than that, that's new information.
But I think we can try to simulate what happens, to see at what happens if you have a field of kilogauss amplitude and let it evolve, and you can try with 100 gauss. I think this would be rather reasonable for that sort of magnetic stars.
I mean, the question is whether it makes any difference.
Yes, right. I mean, because if Sasha, I mean, behind your question was if you can't even get it again, it's not going to happen.
I mean, if it's just our weak seed field, the MRI amplifies that.
Right. Well, but you explore the parameter space like usual.
These simulations are challenging. We're crossing the threshold.
Do you think these observations are more challenging?
Well, I know. Well, again, okay, let me get on my soapbox again. But, you know, one of the purposes of this program is to identify where we can make progress.
I think the thing that we just identified, you look at the X-ray emission from, maybe it's done, right? I just don't know. Yeah. And look at the X-ray emission from detail systems in the gap, right? That would be an interesting one. You still have the problem.
But someone said that they're working on it? Is that, are you working on it?
I think there are some extra, I mean, I think Boris or somebody did.
Could be.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that they don't exist.
Yeah, I just don't remember what happened.
You know more, Jan?
No, I don't remember reading a paper about these models, specifically about systems in the grid gap. It's also difficult to prove if it's a detached CP or
yeah, but that doesn't matter very much, because what this is about is that the secondary is tightly locked to the orbit and therefore fast rotating, right? And it's a low mass star. So we know that those hinges in the gap are what is a 0.2 solar mass, right? So they're very similar, as we have just been finding out over the last week, right? To the secondaries in CVs, and they're rotating fast, right? So then I think it doesn't really matter whether they are detached CVs, or if they're both combinant low binaries that just happen to form in. But low mass stars are horrible. We don't understand. Well, actually, just look at their even a mass radius relation of low mass stars doesn't exist. They do not have a unique mass radius relation.
As you will find,
even single ones.
I mean, right? That's why the KITP is organizing a whole program starting next week on massive. Stuff.
Because they're simple.
Because they're simple.
Massive stars are simple compared to low mass stars. And they're horrible.
Speaking of that,
as a philosophical issue, that's exactly the reason why you do not simulate the observation, because you simulate the physics. Try to understand.
No, you put in the physics to simulate the observations. That's what you do. You don't simulate physics.
You run numerical experiments to see if you understand what the agreements are. Because we'll never, if you throw all the physics in your simulations and by some miracle you reproduce the observations, you don't actually understand what's going on in the system. So,
And besides, it'll fail anyway.
It'll fail anyway.
There are
fundamental physics questions like, you know, do you generate large scale dynamos that can generate large scale fields that can generate winds?
Yeah.
That's a physics question.
Yeah.
And the kind of thing that is addressable.
Yeah. All I'm saying is that low mass stars are not easy to use as test particles, right? Because even the things that we know from more massive stars, like the unique mass radius relation, etc., do not exist, does not exist. There is a large spread on that, which probably has to do with, you know, magnetic fields and generation dynamos and whatever. That's also something that we don't understand.
Speaking of that, there are a couple of objects with very long periods.
Yeah.
Where the Roche lobe is like two solar masses, and spectra shows M star, and people.
What do you mean the Roche lobe is two solar masses? You mean that the mass of the secondary from the Roche lobe should be two solar masses?
Yeah, I think that's what
Okay.
Yeah.
But then they're evolved.
But the spectra is like dwarf M star.
Yeah, evolved stars, right? Going to the giant branch. Not so strange. They're off the main sequence. The same happens on the other side as well, right? We see very short periods in the K-types that shouldn't fit because they're peeled off, right? No stellar evolution, so that's why the MCVNs are so light, because there's no stellar evolution in that.
Yeah, that's the reason
why they're so simple, right? And it looks like there is a simple...
So that here, donor star has no magnetic field?
Well, that I cannot tell you. I'm only saying that, you know, their stellar structure is much more simple. So if you say that the degenerate stars can't hold magnetic fields, then that's it. But it looks like, but I have to put in the caveat that we only know 51 systems instead of a few thousand, right? So of course in the zoo of 1,000 animals, you'll find a few more oddballs than in the zoo of 50 animals, right? It looks like it's better behaved.
Well, but they've gone through
those.
Of course, the neutron stars have no magnetic field at all. We know that.
I'm not being cynical here.
But degenerate stars are not.
They don't
probably
have
not convective. They're probably. I mean, they're just.
They have no internal evolution, right? Yeah. So they're no internal source of energy that drives further evolution. And that's why I personally think that might explain why, from the ones that we see, it looks like they are following a more unique mass ratio, orbital period mass transfer relation.
And they do. So there's a much tighter relationship.
Yeah, yeah. If you look at the paper, the observational paper would be the one from David Levithan and Tree and Obama and myself.
Okay.
And then the theoretical explanation of that was given by John Canito and Gijs Emmermans last year.
Can you send me those references?
Yeah, sure.
Or post them on the wiki.
But I'll make the caveat again, 51 systems only, right? So.
And even within the 51, there's three passive evolution.
There is?
Three passive evolution.
Well.
So
two, I would say. Two. The third one we don't take into account. That's CVs. Two plus. But they're still, I mean, both of them are semi-degenerate or degenerate. By now they're degenerate.
Secondary. So it just depends on how old they are when they go. How much they've lost there.
We can complicate it further, but I don't know.
It's not as simple as you think.
So the secondary can either come from a white dwarf that first cooled, became degenerate, and then came into contact and started mass transfer. Or the secondary can come from a helium star that came into contact, started being peeled off, and then basically became semi-degenerate at the orbital period minimum, and then cools down. Right? But there are two paths in which you can make a secondary, but both of them are, at the moment that we see them now, are degenerate objects that are. It's just that the entropy of the system at the moment that the mass transfer started.
Okay, sorry, I didn't mean to hijack the discussion. I did.
That's good.
But
you want
but
to.
I see. Yeah, someone else can hijack it.
So turning things around, right? So it's clear that you want us to get a handle on the magnetic field strength of the secondaries? What else do you want us to get a handle on?
Entropic gradients in the disk would be nice.
Entropic gradients in the disk. What will be the observational signature of that?
You'll tell me, I don't know.
Wait, what, you, but not in CVs, you mean?
Well, in dark nova, it would be nice to, if it's possible to measure that. Basically, we need to know the density gradient and temperature gradient.
The radial. Oh, but there is.
Radial temperature gradient, we know something about.
What is it?
Thickness of the equation stream. And that's quite important.
That we is difficult. The thickness of the stream is very difficult to get.
The eclipse mapping really gives you a lot of information about the radial structure.
And what is it then?
So it's in the outer disk, it generally follows the Shapiro-Shinyaev gradient, but then it flattens if you go into the disk.
For the density or temperature?
Temperature.
But you get only the effective temperature.
That's the effective temperature, yes, that's correct.
It's not the central temperature, which you probably are interested in.
Yes.
And the density, you know well. Either.
Yeah. The density, you don't measure. But if you want to get a hold of the magnetic field of the secondaries, the best candidates probably are low-rate accretion polars, where you need some magnetic field, kilogaussis, to make the coupling of the magnetic field, because the magnetic field of the primary is not enough to reach the, in these systems, the secondary. So you have to have them coupled because of
So these are systems where you don't form a disk at all, and just
no
But why do you need the coupling?
Why? Because otherwise you don't succeed to provide a mass transfer.
Why not? If the secondary just fits into the flow.
It doesn't.
Why not?
They are detached.
I always happily ignored all the magnetic systems.
The accretion rate there is 10 to minus 13. So if you have a Roeschel over field, it should be more. And I think there was some, I don't know, direct or indirect,
but that's just
that they are not feeling their Roeschel.
Then you're just increasing from a wind, right?
Yes. But in order to again, in order to accrete the whole wind, you have to, wind is very small. You need the whole wind.
You need the whole wind. Minus 11 solar masses a year, which can very well be for like the active M star, right? You only need to accrete 1% of the mass loss in the wind.
Which is already...
which is, but
it could as well be that the... you are deviating from the secular mean and you are in a low state, because in normal Mercury's itself is as low state, and all AM stars are very low state.
Yes, that's correct.
During which the mass transfer rate drops by an order of magnitude.
Sometimes it shuts off completely.
And can go to zero. So you could just be seeing those systems which are in a low state, very low state. And that depends on the could depend on the magnetic cycles of the secondary.
That's correct.
Of something which is precisely a low mass star, for which you don't know much.
Okay, maybe we should stop at this point. Thank you.
Thank you.